Is communism undemocratic? Communists are the most active of propagandists, constantly seeking to spread their influence and increase their numbers. But they do not hope ever to win a majority by persuasion and propaganda. Neither would they be prepared to wait for the completion of that process, even though they thought it might in time be achieved. The whole of communist hopes for the achievement of power are dependent upon the use of violence as a means of imposing a system of communism upon an unwilling and unprepared majority. Their aim is not to win a majority, but to build up a hard, reliable core of determined supporters who, by superior organization and strategy, can exploit a difficult situation when it arises. This is how power was achieved in Russia, and the process has, since the war, been repeated many times in the countries of Eastern Europe. There, the presence of the Red Army and the opportunity to deal with many of the communist opponents during the war itself by means of the resistance movements and later purges of collaborators reduced the violence at the time of the seizure of power to a minimum. But those conditions are recognized as peculiar ones, unlikely to occur again except by means of Soviet warlike expansion. Elsewhere, heavy revolution on the lines of the Russian model is anticipated and prepared for. Following the usual tactics, however, the communists use parliamentary institutions and democratic organizations for the pursuit of their aims, whilst having nothing but contempt for them and every intention of abolishing them at the earliest possible moment. Harry Pollitt, the British leader, had many times on the radio and elsewhere claimed that communism is simply socialism in its working clothes. This is one of those homely, meaningless phrases which the communists use so successfully to deceive the unsuspecting. On the face of it, it appears, insofar as it means anything at all, to suggest that this is just a working-class version of something with which we are already familiar and which is accepted as part of our democracy. But we should not be taken in by such phrases. The whole theory of Marxism builds up to the need for revolutionary action, and on this, the leading writers are quite specific. Said Lenin in his book, What is to be Done, also quoted by Stalin in Foundations of Leninism, quote, "Without a revolutionary theory, there can be no revolutionary movement," end quote. And that is the main goal of all the communist theorizing and practical activities. Karl Marx in The German Ideology wrote, quote, "This revolution is necessary, therefore, not only because the ruling class cannot be overthrown in any other way, but also because the class overthrowing it can only in a revolution succeed in ridding itself of all the muck of the ages and become fitted to found society anew," end quote. What sort of society is intended, we have already seen. And so each of the leading Marxist theorists has written at length on the theory and practice of insurrection, or as Engels and later Lenin called it, the art of insurrection. Works by these writers in which the guiding principles are clearly laid down are published by the Communist Party publishers in this country and sold in numbers to their sympathizers. They are studied with great care, and education courses are based upon them in which all party members are expected to participate. The lessons learned from the failure of the Paris Commune in 1871 and the success of the October Revolution in Russia in 1917 are learned by heart and kept ready for the day when they may be applied here in Britain and throughout the world. In The Condition of the Working Class, Engels declared, quote, "The war of the poor against the rich will be the bloodiest ever waged," end quote. And Marx in The Poverty of Philosophy said, quote, "Combat or death, bloody struggle or extinction, it is thus that the question is inexorably put," end quote. And after the revolution, what then? There have, after all, been other ideals that men have thought worth shedding blood for. Communism, too, claims to be an ideal. It fights, it says, on behalf of the working class, who are the majority class in any modern society. According to the communist leaders and pamphleteers, its purpose is to end the exploitation of man by man, introduce social and economic justice at last, and establish a classless society. May it not be that such ends justify the means? It is by reasoning in this way that many people find themselves inside the party. But there is a vast gulf between the slogans and the reality. Between the braided dictators of the Eastern European countries and the common people lies a vast gulf, and the communist parties of those countries, far from bridging it, simply widen it as time goes on, and the communist leadership becomes more and more entrenched as a class apart. The so-called dictatorship of the proletariat is, in fact, a dictatorship of the communist party, and because of the way in which it is organized, that in turn narrows down to a dictatorship of the four or five who constitute the party's political bureau. The form of organization employed by the communist parties of the world is known as centralized democracy, but it has nothing to do with democracy as it is known and practiced elsewhere. Its methods of election and determining of policy are the exact reverse of that which obtains in genuinely democratic organizations. Instead of policies being determined by the membership and imposed upon the leaders, the opposite obtains. Policy is decided by the Political Bureau, which is made up of a handful of the top leaders. They then see that the policy is endorsed by the larger executive committee. Leads and directives are then handed down to the district and branch committees. There is considerable discussion at every level, but it is within the well-defined limits set by the original Political Bureau recommendations and usually turns on their local application rather than on their content. A branch finding itself in disagreement with the main line of the party may express its point of view at annual Congress, but if defeated, must then accept the majority decision as absolutely binding. If it persists in raising the question again, it will find itself dissolved, with its leaders expelled. This happened quite recently in the case of a branch of the British Party. So that, in practice, the very few individuals who make up the Political Bureau are all-powerful on policy questions. So far as their position in the organization is concerned, they are in an equally strong position. Instead of elections coming through nominations from below, the panels method is employed. Nominations are accepted from the branches and district committees prior to annual Congress, but the Political Bureau itself selects a full list of those whom it would like to see constituting the executive committee and presents the names as a panel to the executive committee for endorsement. Then, at Congress, a small panels commission is set up, led by a member of the Political Bureau and filled with reliable comrades. The branch nominees and those of the executive are considered by the commission. The panel of names put forward will be accepted in whole or with only the slightest of alterations, and then put before Congress for endorsement as a whole, not individually. Congress can in theory reject them, but again it must reject the list as a whole. In practice, it of course accepts, and the people selected by the Political Bureau then constitute the new executive committee, who proceed to appoint the new bureau, which means that they reappoint the existing one. Thus, the Communist Party leader is in an almost unshakable position, provided that he plays ball with the other leaders. And if and when his party captures power, he inevitably becomes one of the tiny ruling clique with a power greater than any ruling monarch ever enjoyed in the past. Stalin in Russia, Tito in Yugoslavia, Dimitrov in Bulgaria, these men have a power such as has never been known among rulers before, and they are all the stronger for the fact that they have a disciplined party of zealots supporting them and believing that by their centralized democracy, they are controlling them. So it is that the achievement of power by the communists means the destruction of democracy and of personal liberty. Behind the slogans and the shouting is the cold science of Marxism, concerned not with human beings as such, but with the establishment of a guinea pig world based on the anti-religious, soulless teachings of Marx and Engels. Does it serve the cause of communism? That is the only consideration. The individual communist in the state counts for nothing. Yet by skillful propaganda, education and dialectical materialism, and terrorism where necessary, he can be brought to believe that he is participating in a great experiment in which he has a part to play and responsibilities to fulfill. So it is that decisions can be made and operated which will blight the lives of hundreds of thousands, and the party membership, at least, will believe the suffering involved to be justified because it serves the cause. Thus, entire populations can be uprooted and shifted to another part or dispersed throughout the land to serve some tactical political consideration. When Tito's government in Yugoslavia found it impossible to destroy an armed opposition which was functioning in the mountain areas, the entire populations of towns and villages were moved out and scattered throughout the land in order to destroy the guerrilla's base. In the USSR, areas occupied by the Nazis suffered appalling devastation as the war swung to and fro across them. The people were subjected to the worst of humiliations and cruelties by the invading Germans. But at the conclusion of the war, the Russian leaders took the view that the population of such areas was likely to have been corrupted by bourgeois influences during the occupation, and so, after all the horrors they had already endured, they were torn up by their roots from the places which had been their homes and sent east to the vast, underpopulated areas of Siberia where they can do no harm. Such decisions, appalling in their tragic human consequences, are normal to communism and can be fully justified according to Marxist standards. For, it can be argued, the victims suffer that the cause of communism may prevail. The utter abandonment of all ideas about the sanctity of the individual, which is a feature of Christian teaching, leads inevitably to such consequences.